Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington, and here are some of the stories we're covering today, Wednesday, October 23rd, 2019. Some South Sudanese are dead after heavy flooding hits Bia State.
Another concern
is that when there is water like this, there is a waterborne disease, of course, and people are dying from different diseases.
And South Sudan opposition lawmakers say they had no choice but to leave a Juba hotel.
We are very disappointed with this treatment because it means that we are not able to do the work that we are supposed to be doing here.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Heavy floods have killed at least four people and displaced thousands of others in more than a dozen villages of Bia State. The state's governor says homes, crops, and the state's only health care facility were destroyed in the floods. Viola Elias reports for VOA from Juba.
Speaking by phone from the state capital Wad, Bia Governor Moses Majok Egaluak says the flooding has affected 11 counties of the state and displaced thousands of people from 11 villages. He says state authorities are having a difficult time assessing damage in the most affected areas.
Another concern is that when there is water like this, there is a waterborne disease, of course, and people are dying from different diseases, and we don't have a health facility. Everything is destroyed. There is no food at all.
Flooding occurs in South Sudan about this time every year, but this year the floods are particularly heavy. Galwak is appealing to aid agencies to ramp up humanitarian assistance quickly.
Our people need food, need shelters.
Our people need food, shelter, and also we need non-food items. And also we need medicines. We need humanitarian agencies to come and assess the area.
Doctors Without Borders, or MSF, says heavy flooding has also displaced thousands of people in Boma State, Bibor County. Kim Hyangs, the head of Mission MSF Belgium, says the flood forced the aid agency to shut down its hospital in Bibor County for a few days. He says some of the group's medical equipment is underwater, forcing medical workers at the facility to discharge patients early.
We had to evacuate it. We kept on running it as long as we could. The ground is not really leveled, so little by little, each ward, like first an adult IDP ward, like in hospitalized patients, had to be closed. We kept on shuffling patients to different wards that was not flooded yet, until there was like no place to go anymore, but by that time we had the tent hospital built.
Hyang says at one point the generator had to be shut off due to high water. He says one of four patients on life support died.
For one newborn, this oxygen was crucial, so we could not save the child. Unfortunately, he died. We tried to continue our care as much as possible.
Yang says hundreds of people in Bibor have been cut off from medical care due to heavy flooding. He says MSF will continue working in the new tent hospital located on higher ground until flooding subsides in the area. Last week, the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, reported heavy flooding in Maban County of Northern Upper Nile State affected nearly 2,000 people, including 150,000 refugees from Sudan's Blue Nile region. In its latest update on South Sudan humanitarian situation, the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, or UN OCHA, says heavy rains and flooding in parts of the country displaced thousands of people and increased malaria cases. For VOA News, I am Viola Elias in Juba.
Police in the Australian city of Melbourne have arrested more than 50 South Sudanese youth in an operation aimed at cracking down on criminals across the state. Australia's ABC News reported that the arrests were made over the weekend in the Melbourne suburbs of Cranbourne, Dandenong, Reservoir and Sunshine. My colleague John Tanza is in Melbourne and describes why the young South Sudanese were arrested.
Yeah, the police commissioner of Victoria State issued a statement that they cracking down on what they are calling repeat offenders. And in legal terms, repeat offenders are people who commit crime every now and then, meaning like you have a record of committing several crimes. And so the police is saying they are trying to arrest the repeat offenders in a bid to reduce the rate of crime in the city of Melbourne.
Now, local news says that dozens were arrested. The figure from ABC Australia is 57. 57 people were arrested. Do we know how many of those were South Sudanese?
I spoke to one South Sudanese community leader here in Melbourne, and he told me out of the 57, 54 are South Sudanese youth aging from 17 to 18. And the community is quite alarmed by this round of arrests. The police were actually going door to door and running some... Looks like the police had good information where to get these repeat offenders, because once you're arrested, your records are up for, you know, checks and stuff like that.
What are some of the crimes that these young people are alleged to have committed?
The police say housebreaking, carjacking, and shoplifting. I mean, there are lots of stories in Melbourne here. You can also see it on the TV. A huge number of young people, visibly South Sudanese, who walk into a shopping center and break into a gold shop or a supermarket and just run with items. And so this is what the police are saying they are trying to prevent from occurring frequently, and so they're going after those that they've arrested before who have committed similar crimes.
And in fact, South Sudanese youth make news in Australia often for the wrong reasons, as you just mentioned. And I've read instances, as you said, where police accuse South Sudanese, young South Sudanese, of disturbance of the peace, shoplifting. Are South Sudanese communities aware of the issues involving their youth?
The community leaders that I've spoken to have said repeatedly that they are aware that this is a problem and they would like to work with the Australian authorities to address this problem. But it appears like their attempts have been overtaken by these events where these youth are being rounded and arrested and put into custody. And I've also spoken to one lady from an African country, I'll not mention her name here for privacy reasons, who works at the prison facility. She told me that there are lots of South Sudanese in prisons in Australia for, you know, various ranges of crimes, and it's not a very good picture out there.
Have community leaders offered you an explanation of why so many young people find themselves in these situations?
Some of the community leaders who spoke to me say that the drivers of this crime should be traced back to the type of resettlement process that were offered to South Sudanese here in Australia. When the Australian government was taking South Sudanese here, they were interested in taking women whose husbands died during the war in what was then Sudan, or women who were facing persecution in what was then Sudan. So most of the families that came here were mothers with their children, and the father figurehead came late when some of these kids were already grown up and, you know, life in the West. It's a capital economy. People are busy running to make money to pay their bills. And so some of these kids have been left on their own, and they got some role models on the streets, or some people became their role models.
That is my colleague John Tanza speaking with reporter Ayan Bior this past hour from Melbourne, Australia. Officials with South Sudan's ceasefire monitoring body and opposition military commanders say soldiers are deserting cantonment sites in droves across South Sudan because they don't have enough to eat. One opposition commander running a cantonment site in northern Bahar el-Ghazal says up to 700 soldiers registered at Pantit have deserted that site. Dimo Silva Aurelio recently visited the site and has this report for VOA from Juba.
Soldiers with the South Sudan Opposition Alliance sing morale-boosting songs at Pantit, one of the largest cantonment sites in northern Bahr-el-Ghazal, located about 75 kilometers northwest of Awil town near the Sudan border. A few grass thatch huts called tukuls are visible on the site. The soldiers are expected to be screened and trained as part of an 83,000-strong unified national army per the revitalized peace agreement. For the first time since the site opened in August, officials with the ceasefire and transitional security arrangements monitoring and verification mechanism visited Pantit on Friday to assess progress on cantoning, screening, registering and training of the soldiers. The peace deal requires that before the parties form a unity government, opposition forces be cantoned, registered and trained jointly with government forces and deployed as a unified national army. Very little progress has been made on that front as the November 12 deadline to form a unity government quickly approaches. Though the soldiers look physically weak, they say they are ready for training. Brigadier Ajong Ayaga, a member of the Joint Military Commission, the body tasked with registering forces, says there is a big problem facing soldiers at Pantit.
The problem is hunger and sickness, which has sent most of them out. As you can see, their bodies were not like this before. This is because they are sick with malaria and also they have no sleeping mats.
Lieutenant General Nicodemus Dengdeng says the last time food was delivered to the site was in August, which he says include 200 bags of sorghum, 100 bags of rice, 120 bags of lentils and 50 jerrycans of oil.
I do receive the food on August 8. The food that we receive is very limited food, and really it's not feeding the people enough. But now that food is finished, and we remain suffering. So no food on ground.
Deng says soldiers survive on food provided by nearby residents. Speaking in Dinka, Regina Ajok says she is one of those residents.
We have visitors who come to us here and they have no food, no water for drinking, and they also don't have jerrycans for collecting water. But we, the hosts, are also suffering. When medicines are brought to the hospital and our children fall sick of malaria, we always don't get medicine.
William J. Gallagher, the ceasefire and transitional security arrangement monitoring mechanism chief of staff, says the situation at Pantit is typical of most cantonment areas across the country.
Many of those soldiers that registered have since deserted because of the unacceptable living conditions that they have there.
Gallagher says the government must ensure that security arrangements are implemented quickly.
It's a very, very severe problem that thousands and thousands of soldiers and their family members are facing right now across South Sudan in the cantonment sites with no food, mostly with no water, and all of them with no medicine of any kind. And they are desperate. They are angry, and they see no solution to the problem.
SPLM IO leader Riek Machar, who held face-to-face talks with President Salva Kiir in Juba last weekend, said he would not be part of a unity government next month if outstanding issues, including security arrangements, are not resolved. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Some opposition lawmakers say they had to leave a Juba hotel earlier today. Find out why when we return.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what does peace mean to you?
Peace, I can describe it in different ways. Peace means absence of instability. There is no war. There's no injustice. When I live in a very conducive place, I have a good shelter. I have freedom to do everything that I think I have to do as a citizen in that particular country.
Peace, well, I think it's when you're at your happiest and you just feel happy, nothing but joy. That's peace to me.
Well, peace is just like everybody should be allowed to stay without harm, harassment, for whatever reason, the economical, political, all these wars, all these religious blackmails, all these people trying to impose their ideology on you, you know.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1-202-630-8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1-202-630-8011.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. At least three members of the South Sudan Opposition Alliance say they have left a hotel in Juba today because of what they call unbearable living conditions. They say management has denied them basic services like food and electricity for nearly 2 weeks now due to unpaid hotel bills. It is not clear how many opposition officials remain at that hotel. Lasuba Memo has more for VOA from Juba.
Josephine Lagu, chairperson of the SOA, says a lack of basic services forced the opposition politicians to leave the Dembesh Hotel in Juba.
We are very disappointed. We are very disappointed with this treatment because it means that we are not able to do the work that we are supposed to be doing here. You cannot even read anything. There is no television. We are basically cut off.
Lagu spoke to South Sudan in Focus minutes before leaving the Dembesh, where SOA officials have been residing for nearly a year. Their accommodations, up until a few weeks ago, were paid for by the government. Joseph Bangasi Bakasoro, head of the National Democratic Movement for Change, which is affiliated with the South Sudan Opposition Alliance, left the same hotel days earlier for the same reason.
We found ourselves in a very awkward situation and each one has to decide to find where to stay. Provided that I'm not in the hotel at the moment. Some of my colleagues are also the same way. So we are staying at large. Provided that we come, we continue focusing on the implementation of the peace rather than dwelling on something which we are not part of it.
Lagu and Bakasoro both say when they inquired about the cut in services at the hotel, they were told the government had not paid some of the accommodation fees. Lagu says he wonders why the National Pre-Transitional Committee is not paying the hotel fees.
Why are the hotel bills not being paid? Why are they not being paid? You cannot have, services free of charge. So we are not so much blaming the hotels as such, but we are blaming the people who have put us here and why they are not settling the bills, which they should.
This is not the first time opposition officials have had trouble with hotel accommodations. In March, dozens of government and opposition officials appointed to committees implementing the revitalized peace deal were locked out of their hotel rooms due to unpaid bills. Hotel managers at the time demanded the government pay millions of dollars in arrears for accommodating government officials and various delegations since 2013. Lagu says she believes NPTC funds may be mismanaged. When asked whether the delay in paying hotel bills for the opposition is political, Bakasoro had this to say.
I don't think really it is political. It is administrative. You need the money from me, and if I don't get your money, then you can take your decision. So it is not more of political, really. It is an administrative issue.
Josephine and Bakasoro both say they support the formation of a unity government by the November 12 deadline, and they remain committed to implementing the revitalized peace agreement despite their current challenges. When asked to comment on the matter, Gabriel Changson Chang, NPTC deputy chairperson, said he was at Juba International Airport catching a plane to Djibouti. He was leading a delegation of NPTC members, including Angelina Teng and government spokesman Michael McQuay, for an undisclosed mission. Martin Elielu Moro, the NPTC Secretary for Finance, did not answer repeated calls for reaction to this story. For VOA News, I am Lasuba Memo in Juba.
Cameroon's government says more than 400 refugees from the Central African Republic have agreed to voluntarily return home today, while others are expected to follow later this year. VOA's Jackson Mvunganyi spoke with reporter Moki Edwin Kinzeka from a refugee camp in eastern Cameroon. He says the refugees agreed to repatriate following an agreement between the governments of Cameroon, the CAR, and the UN Refugee Agency in June.
I am precisely at Gado Bajiri, a refugee camp in eastern Cameroon, sharing boundary with the Central African Republic, where about 400 Central African Republic refugees have agreed to go back to their countries. And the 400 who are living now are saying that they have hope that the situation in the country has improved, that they are counting on the governments of their country for peace to return to their country once and for all, so that they can start living again, they can start their lives all over. 5 ministers from the Central African Republic, including the Minister of Interior, the Minister of Women's Affairs, and the Minister of Women's Empowerment, are all on the other side of the border to welcome the refugees who are going back home. After about 3 years, they can go back to their country.
Right. Now, Moki, these refugees were reluctant to return home to the Central African Republic. What was their fear in the first place, and what kind of assurances did they have to get before agreeing to this repatriation?
They were afraid because of the insecurity in their country. You know, the anti-Balaka and the armed groups were still very much present, fighting in their country. So the assurance they have came after the Khartoum peace talks that brought together all of the rival factions, the factions that were fighting their country, and they agreed that peace returned. It is true there were some skirmishes after the peace talks in Khartoum, but for the past 4, 5, 6 months, there have not been conflicts. That is why the United Nations High Commission for Refugees, the government of Cameroon, and the government of the Central African Republic think that there is peace already, and these refugees can go back to their country.
Now, only 400 or 500 of these refugees is a small fraction compared to the over 250,000 refugees of Central African Republic refugees currently in Cameroon refugee camps. Is there hope that more are going to be on board with this, that there are more refugees that are going to be returning home soon? And most importantly, I guess the question I wanted to ask is, who is handling the logistics of this repatriation?
There are about 300,000 Central African refugees in Cameroon. Out of that number, only 6,000 have agreed to go back home voluntarily. You see, some are still afraid, some are still reluctant, some are still asking what they'll be doing back home because they are starting their small businesses in Cameroon. But those who are going back are taken care of by the government of the Central African Republic and the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, which have given them some logistics, they have given them some means. The Minister of Central African Republic in charge of Interior was telling us today that they are giving them some logistics, some means to start little businesses and assuring them of their security. And we are sure from what is said here that if there is peace and if those who are going now really successfully are installed, then many more want to go back home because their fear is what they will be doing when they get back to the Central African Republic. So logistics are provided by the CAR government, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, and some assistance by the Cameroon government.
In the population of refugees, are there some who are still skeptical of the peace deal?
Yes, a lot of them. There are about 300,000 Central African refugees in Cameroon. Only 6,000 are agreed to go back. Many of them are still doubting. They still wonder if they are going to be assured of their security when they go back home. Some are saying that after the peace deal, only about 6 of members of the rebel faction were taken by President Ashkan Tuadera in his government. So they're doubting if the others who are still disgruntled will not start trouble one day. So there are still some who fear going back. But they're saying that they want to observe when the first set of refugees go back, then they will see if the situation is calm before they can start thinking of going back to the Central African Republic.
That was reporter Moki Edwin Kinzeka in eastern Cameroon speaking earlier today with VOA's Jackson Mvuganyi. Russian President Vladimir Putin opened a major summit today aimed at reviving Russia's influence in Africa, telling leaders from the continent he would seek to double trade in the coming years. All 54 African states were represented at the first Russia-Africa summit in the Black Sea resort of Sochi, with Putin set to hold bilateral talks throughout the day. VOA's Jamie Detmer is in Sochi and spoke with my colleague Douglas Mpuga a short while ago for an update on the summit.
There are about 3,000 at least representatives from every single African state. There are 44 prime ministers and presidents. It's the biggest gathering of African dignitaries in Russia since the end of communism, since the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. And the Kremlin has been pulling out all the stops to get as many African politicians to attend. The last few years they've been crisscrossing the continent as much as possible to get people to come to Sochi.
Is the primary focus of this summit trade?
Well, that's the position of the Kremlin. It's primarily about trade and cooperation with African states. We had the announcement today by Vladimir Putin that they're forgiving about $20 billion of Soviet-era debt that African states owned Russia. On the other hand, that debt has never been repaid in all the years since. A lot of Western debt hasn't and has been forgiven as well. Yes, certainly they want to increase trade in the nuclear field, in raw minerals, in agriculture. But at the same time, despite what the Russian president is saying, there's no political strings attached to this this trading. The Kremlin sees this as a geopolitical move as well, and Kremlin officials are not shy about bragging that they will restore Russian influence on the continent in competition with Western states, including the United States, and with China. And there are arms trading is a lot behind this. There are 23 security cooperation deals already signed between African states and Russia. They're now the biggest supplier of arms to the continent, and they want to increase that.
You talk of the Soviet era. Moscow was a crucial player in Africa in the Soviet era, backing independence movements and training a generation of African leaders. But in recent years, China has emerged as a top foreign player on the continent. Do you think Russia is playing catch-up?
Well, I think it is catch-up. They're coming this late in the game. Their trade is worth about $20 billion compared to $200 billion in terms of the Chinese trading with Africa. The European Union is trading, I think, the value of about $300 billion. So it is a bit of a catch-up situation for them. Of course, in the Soviet era, they were big players in Africa. When the Soviet Union collapsed, they were cash-strapped, they were disoriented, they were really focused on themselves, the Russians, and so this has been a late spurt. And some of it is propelled in terms of geopolitical competition, but as well as that, because of Western sanctions on Russia, they are looking for new trading partners.
In the Soviet era, they had an influence on some African countries, but now it seems, given the number of presidents attending, they want the whole continent.
Well, yes. I mean, they are trying to revive some of those old ties with places like Angola and Mozambique, but they're also trying to shape and craft new ties, for example, with Nigeria, which is a former British colony, as you know. It's a mixture of an old approach and a new one.
That is VOA's Jamie Detmer speaking with my colleague Douglas Mpuga earlier today from Sochi, Russia. And that's our show for this Wednesday. We leave you now with the song Education by the Genesis Nursery School in Nimele.
This is Genesis Nasaran Primary School, South Sudan. This song goes to you all parents. Be blessed.
Just sort of taste of the Genesis Nursery School in Nimele singing Education. Hope you like that. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from The Voice of America.